This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In this edition today, our bulletin of church news to be followed by Panorama, and then our feature of culture and society. Today we shall close with a segment dedicated to young people. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. The Vatican announced on Thursday that Pope Francis is going to travel to the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan for an ecumenical peace pilgrimage. This apostolic journey was originally scheduled to take place in July of 2022, but had to be postponed because the Pope had a health problem in his knees. The 85-year-old Pope apologized in June for having to put off the trip and promised to reschedule it as soon as possible. Thaddeus Jones reports.
Pope will travel to the Democratic Republic of the Congo from January 31st to February 3rd, visiting the city of Kinshasa, and after that he'll travel to South Sudan, where together with the Archbishop of Canterbury and the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, they'll together make what's being called an ecumenical pilgrimage of peace to Juba in that nation from February 3rd to February 5th. Highlights of the Pope's journey will include a visit with people who are victims of the unrest in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and in South Sudan, a meeting with internally displaced persons, and the ecumenical prayer service. With the formal announcement of the Pope's visit, the Holy See Press Office released the schedule for the journey to the two nations, and in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Pope will first stop in Kinshasa, where he'll visit with the president of the republic and meet with the local authorities and representatives of civil society and the diplomatic corps. The following day, on Wednesday, February 1st, there'll be mass at the Ndolo airport and meetings with victims of the unrest from the eastern part of the country later in the afternoon, followed by meetings with representatives of the various charities working in the area there at the Apostolic Nunciature. On February 2nd, Thursday, the Pope will meet with young people and catechists at the stadium there in Kinshasa, followed by a prayer meeting with the priests, deacons, and consecrated persons there at the Cathedral Notre Dame du Congo. In his visit to South Sudan, the Pope arrives there on Friday, the 3rd of February in the afternoon, and he'll visit with the President of the Republic and also meet with the vice presidents as well and meet with local authorities. On Saturday, the following day in Juba, the Pope will meet with the bishops and local church representatives at the cathedral, followed by a meeting with internally displaced persons in the afternoon, along with an ecumenical prayer service later. On Sunday, in Juba, the Pope will celebrate Mass, followed by the farewell ceremony when he then returns to Rome in the evening. I'm Thaddeus Jones.
Pope Francis on Thursday addressed participants at the 2022 Ratzinger Prize Award ceremony. Recipients of the award this year are Father Michel Fedou and Professor Joseph Halevi Horowitz Weyler, who were presented with the prestigious award. In his speech at the event, Pope Francis highlighted the significant contributions of the recipients. Father Benedict Mayaki reports.
The Ratzinger Prize, launched in 2011, is given to scholars who have stood out for their scientific research in the theological field, much like Pope Benedict XVI. In his speech, Pope Francis highlighted the spiritual presence and accompaniment in prayer of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI for the whole Church, and said that the occasion reaffirmed the contribution of his theological work and thought, which continue to be fruitful and operative. He also recalled Father Ratzinger's role at the Second Vatican Council, first as an expert who helped in the creation of some of the Council's documents, and then in his calling as Pope Benedict XVI in leading the ecclesial community in its implementation. Pope Francis said that Benedict XVI's contributions offer us a solid theological basis for the Church's journey, which he taught us to live as communion, guided by the Spirit of the Lord, open to the mission of proclaiming the gospel in the world. Pope Francis then shifted his attention to the prize winners. Concerning Father Fedou, the Pope noted that this master of Christian theology has dedicated his life to study and teaching, particularly of the works of the Eastern and Western Church Fathers and the development of Christology over the centuries. In Father Fedu, the Pope said, "We recognize and pay tribute to a valiant heir and continuer of the great tradition of French theology." Pope Francis then hailed Professor Weiler as the first adherent of the Jewish faith to be awarded the prestigious prize. The Pope welcomed this, noting that Benedict XVI firmly and proudly affirmed that an objective of his personal theological work had been the sharing and promotion of all the steps of reconciliation between Christians and Jews taken since the Council. Pope Francis hailed the award, noting that in addition to representing a well-deserved recognition, it offers some indication of lines of commitment, study, and life of great significance which elicit our admiration and demand to be proposed for the attention of all. I'm Father Benedict Mayaki.
In his Twitter message on Thursday, Pope Francis spoke about his prayer intention for the month of December. "Let us pray together that volunteer, non-profit and human development organizations may find people willing to commit themselves to the common good and ceaselessly seek out new paths of international cooperation," the Holy Father tweeted on Thursday. You are tuned to the Daily Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
I'm Father Paul Samasumo. According to media reports, Rwandan President Paul Kagame on Wednesday used parliamentary session to accuse DRC leader Felix Tshisekedi of exploiting the ongoing insecurity situation in eastern Congo with the view of postponing next year's presidential elections. President Kagame said he believes the current leadership of the Democratic Republic of Congo was creating a security emergency a year before the country holds presidential elections in order to find reason to postpone the elections scheduled for December 2023. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa is facing renewed pressure after scandal at his private farm, now being referred to as Farmgate. On Wednesday, an independent parliamentary panel found that President Cyril Ramaphosa violated his oath of office. The president immediately denied any wrongdoing. Ramaphosa has not been charged with any crime. In this report, the independent panel said it was evident that Ramaphosa put himself into a situation where there was a conflict of interest between his official responsibility as president and as a business person involved in cattle and game ranching. His actions were inconsistent with his oath of office, the report said. The chances of impeachment are slim given that the ANC has a dominant majority in parliament. Ramaphosa confirmed the robbery at his farm, but has denied any claims of criminal conduct. In June, it emerged that an estimated $4 million United States dollars was stolen at Ramaphosa's farm in 2020, raising questions about how the billionaire president, who took power on the promise to fight corruption, acquired the cash and why he had not declared it. There were also questions about why such a large amount of money was being kept in cushions instead of the bank. Nigeria has announced an educational policy change aimed at promoting the teaching of primary school pupils in their local languages rather than in English. The new framework, known as the National Language Policy, has been approved for implementation. Education Minister Adamu Adamu told journalists on Wednesday that in the new policy, instruction for the first 6 years in primary education will be in the mother tongue. English is Nigeria's official language, and all learning institutions use it as the common language of teaching and learning. However, the education minister says pupils learn much better when they are taught in their own mother tongue. The education minister acknowledged that implementing the new policy would be challenging because it would require a lot of work to develop material to teach and get the teachers. Another challenge is the number of languages spoken in Nigeria. There are more than 600 languages spoken in the country. You are tuned to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
This is Culture and Society, and you are welcome to the program. My name is Kanyan Tagodufri Kampamba. The COVID-19 pandemic is first and foremost a health crisis. When it first appeared, the crisis crystallized the dilemma policymakers faced between closing schools and keeping them open. The severe short-term disruption has been felt by many families around the world, yet experts say that these interruptions cannot just be assigned to a short-term issue because they can also have long-term consequences for the affected groups of people and are likely to increase inequality. Leonardo Garnier is Costa Rica's former education minister and believes that the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on education are so severe that they will only be fully understood in the years to come. Garnier is the special advisor to the Transforming Education Summit, which was scheduled to take place during the opening days of the 77th session of the United Nations General Assembly. The meeting was convened in order to address crucial issues in global education in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. In a special interview with Conor Lennon, Garnier speaks of the impact of COVID-19 on education and how lessons can be learned from a previous education crisis in the 1980s.
The problem here is that the damage done to education shows only after several years. If you take the 80s crisis, it was until the 90s and the 2000s that you started to see how countries had lost because they cut educational investment. So I think it's precisely the right time to do it because first, millions of children were left out of school with the pandemic, but it was not just the pandemic. The pandemic brought out what had been happening for years, which is that you have millions out of school, but even many of those who are in school were not really learning properly. So yes, we have a double educational crisis, one of access and one of relevance of learning.
You're going back to the 80s. Talk us through what happened in that crisis and what the consequences were.
Well, in those years, and my closest experience, of course, is with my own country in Costa Rica and with Latin America. But what you saw in many parts of the world was that with the stagflation, there was a huge reduction in educational budgets, enrollment rates fell, numbers of teachers fell. And what happened was that many of those years' children were left out of education, especially high school. You're still in primary, you had a lot of students, but what that meant is that today's labor force in many countries, only half of them finished primary school, and the other half never went beyond that. So when you look at increasing poverty, when you look at increasing inequality in many countries, it is very difficult not to relate that to the reduced educational opportunities of the 80s and 90s.
And you're concerned that what we're seeing now is going to be potentially a repeat of that?
That could happen because we had been going through some improvements in this century from the 2000 to 2018-19. There had been increases in enrollment rates in most countries and in educational investment. Still with problems of learning, when you look at the real learning outcomes, they are not as good as they should be. But just around 2018-19, you see that educational budgets start to be reduced, and then the pandemic hits. And then what you have is really 2 years where education stopped in many countries. And then you have an economic crisis. So, the risk is there that instead of recovering from the pandemics, we could be even worse than we were in 2019. So what the Secretary General is saying is, first, we have to protect education from this big hit. Second, we must recover what we lost with the pandemic, but that is not good enough. We have to do much more. Almost a catchphrase is that we have to go back to the future. The UN and the global community had set for itself very ambitious goals, at the same time very simple but very ambitious in SDG 4, which is guaranteeing the right of education for everybody. Which is not that much, you would think. I mean, everybody should have right to primary and high school. The truth is that we were not getting there. That goal was set for 2030. And if we keep doing things as we were being doing it prior to the pandemic, we wouldn't get to that goal. So the idea of calling the summit is, listen, we have to do things differently. We have to transform education. We have to transform schools, the way teachers teach, the way we use digital resources, the way we finance education, if we really want to make sure that every young person in this planet has the right to a good education.
Here in New York, children go back to school. I've got a child who went to school, and there's a lot of happiness there because it's the first term that it's been fully in-house. Masks are off now, yeah, and hybrid education, doing lessons from home, that's all finished. And the teachers were happy, the kids were happy to see each other, and that was all great. And I understand that. I can see why it's been so disruptive over the last two, going on 3 years, and, yes, and so many children have suffered from that. But at the same time, the difference with this education crisis is that it's been taking place during a health crisis. And I must admit, I was surprised around a year ago when UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, was insistent that schools should reopen, because we were writing very frequently about the deaths from COVID, yes, the health implications from COVID, and it seemed to be a bit of a mismatch. Yes. And I can understand why UNICEF wanted schools open, but there was, wasn't there, a question of outweighing the risks of no education with the health risk. And how did you see that?
You know, that, it's impossible not to have mixed feelings about that. Because, as you say, we had at the same time a health crisis and lives were in danger. Besides, we didn't really know what was going on when you watched the news and you said, you were listening to doctors saying, well, wash your hands, or no, it's use the mask or the vaccines. So we were really learning day by day what the pandemic was about. And still we don't fully know. So it made sense to have social distancing and to stop schools and to stop all sorts of gatherings. At the beginning, we thought this is going to take 2, 3, 4 months, and then it was 1 year, and then it was 2 years. So you start to balance the health risk with the risk of losing 1, 2, 3 years of education. And that's, when you look at the research of what has happened when children miss several months of education, you don't lose a month. It's a month plus what you forget, plus the lack of relationships. So it's a very difficult decision. So I think that going back to school, but with a lot of protection, using masks, having distance, a lot of air in the classrooms, things like that, made sense. But the other thing which was interesting is that what happened during the pandemic, we learned, and I say we because I was teaching at the university, and suddenly they tell you, you don't have classes, you have to teach using this thing called Zoom or Teams or whatever. And suddenly we realized that there were a lot of tools out there that already existed and that we were not using. And we've seen teachers all over the world using WhatsApp, using email, using videos, using a lot of tools that they could have been using before, but they didn't. So I think that the pandemic showed us that we could do things differently, and that's a plus. That's something that could help us go through this transformation of education.
Costa Rica's former education minister, Leonardo Garnier, talking to United Nations Radio's Conor Lennon about the impact of COVID-19 on education and how lessons can be learned from a previous education crisis in the 1980s. And that is all we have time for in this edition of Culture and Society. Until next week at the same time, my name is Kanyan Tagodufri Kampamba.
Now, news for young people. Come on, close the
open wide the door for everyone. Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali.
artificial intelligence systems are being used in an increasingly large range of toys, games, and educational tools targeting children, but there are few safeguards in place to protect them. Artificial intelligence, or AI, is intelligence demonstrated by machines performing tasks that typically require human intelligence. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, has developed guidelines to help policymakers protect children following consultations with private companies, experts, and young people. Stephen Vosloo, a UNICEF data research and policy specialist, spoke to UN News' Conor Lennon. He began by explaining that the guidance was motivated by the huge growth of AI in people's lives.
We at UNICEF were seeing that AI was a very hot topic and very current and was being recognized as something that would fundamentally change society and economies and the world today and even more so in coming generations. But when we looked at the national AI strategies and even the corporate policies and guidelines that were being developed, we realized that not enough attention was being paid to child users and to children and to how AI impacts them. And not just today, but obviously that impact will grow even more. And so we started this project with the government of Finland, who's been our partner, to look at how we can develop more child-centered AI. We realized that guidance was needed to inform policies and practice. And so we developed such a guidance, which we released last year as a draft. And we went through a fairly extensive consultation process to develop that, speaking to experts around the world, adult experts, but also holding consultations with children, almost 250 children in five countries. And that led to the guidance. And after releasing it, we invited governments and organizations and companies to pilot the guidance, because it's very easy to put down AI principles. There are over 160 different principles in the world for ethical AI and responsible AI. It's much more difficult to practice that. And so we've invited anyone really to use the guidance. And we've been working with eight organizations who've been piloting the guidance, and we are developing case studies around that. So to be able to share the lessons learned of how they've applied the guidance in their particular context and with children and, you know, in their situation.
So were you concerned that even when we're talking about a product like a toy, which is targeted towards children, that the AI used in that was not necessarily appropriate to be used with a child?
Again, it depends how it's used and what kind of protections have been put in place. So if you have an AI-enabled toy, it will be using potentially computer vision to see the child, to see the room for image or object recognition, using natural language processing to understand words and instructions. And so it's collecting a lot of data from that child in terms of conversations. That data is being stored in the cloud often, on commercial servers, and that's a very intimate space for a child to be talking to a toy. And are there enough privacy considerations, surveillance potential considerations? Is the system secure enough? We know of instances where toys have been hacked. And so, for example, in Germany, those types of toys were banned because it just wasn't safe enough.
And you also say that children are interacting with or are impacted by AI systems that are not designed for them.
Yasmina's research with others has shown that at least one third of all online users are children. And we often get younger children using platforms that are social media platforms or video sharing platforms or even search that isn't designed for them at all. And so we really need to think about issues around privacy and around data, potential profiling of users. And I think that this is a really important point, that when any of us use these systems, that they are designed in a certain way, often for maximum engagement, and are built on a certain level of profiling based on data sets that may not represent you as a child and your particular individual characteristics. But you may be profiled in a way that puts you in a certain bucket. It may determine what kind of educational opportunities you have in the future, or what benefits you can access. For children, it's really not just impacting them today, but it could set their whole life course in a different direction. And so that kind of predictive analytics and profiling is particularly relevant when dealing with children and setting their life direction.
Can you just explain what you mean by that?
So, for example, let's say there was an AI-driven educational system that is based on adaptive learning that really gets to know a child and their learning style and collects a lot of information and from that says, this child is a particular learner, X particular learner, or Y particular type of learner, and therefore these subjects or this kind of career option is best suited. But those systems are based on data sets that may not actually have data that represents all different learning styles or all different types of personality traits or learning types. And so it may not accurately actually set, you know, give an accurate reading of ability and of opportunity.
That was Stephen Vosloo, a UNICEF data research and policy specialist, speaking there to UN News' Connor Lennon.
I am Festus Tarawali.
This is the Africa Service of Vatican Radio, and I am Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.